You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is Tea Break Archaeology, where we explore the ancient origins of everyday objects. Hello, and welcome to episode 40 of Tea Break Archaeology. I'm Matilda Siebrecht, and today I am savouring a rooibos caramel tea, because even though it's earlier in the day for our guest, it's quite late for me in the evening, so no caffeine at the moment. But joining me on my tea break today from all the way across the pond is Lisa Fagan-Davis, who is a specialist in medieval manuscripts, which we'll get to later. But for now, welcome, Lisa. And what beverage are you drinking today in your break?
Oh, thank you so much, Matilda. I'm thrilled to be here. I am drinking coffee because I need that caffeine.
That's fair enough. Are you a black coffee, no additions kind of person?
I always add a little half and half. Oh. And I am, in fact, currently drinking my coffee out of a mug with a picture of that very special manuscript that we will be discussing.
How appropriate. Oh, my goodness. Oh, we should have done this as a video podcast. We could have shown it. Maybe you can take a picture and I'll include it on the show notes Sure. So people can see. That's wonderful. So would you say you're mainly a coffee drinker in general, or is it just because it's a special
absolutely.
Time of day?
Okay, fair enough. Until I switch to bourbon at 5 p.m.
Is it? I feel like it's a more American, indeed, coffee is a more American thing and tea is a more British thing. Would you agree?
I think that's correct.
Yeah, no. Oh, well. Well, we're filling our stereotypes today then. But anyway, thank you very much.
People united and divided by a common beverage.
Exactly. And it's still a hot beverage. It still gives a kick, gives some warmth. Yes. I think that's all that's necessary.
Exactly.
I must say, my very first episode that I have had, I asked my guest, what are you drinking? She said, well, I actually don't drink any hot beverages. So I'm having a Coke. And it was like, oh. But it's fine. We now co-host another podcast together, so it's all good. We don't hold it against each other. And thank you very much for joining me on my tea break, your coffee break. So your days, I mean, we're going to get into what exactly you do, but you do so many things. And I always like to ask, because I think it's important to take a break every so often to have a tea or have a coffee or a beverage of choice. So would you say you've got quite a good rhythm during the day? Do you take regular breaks throughout the day, or are you someone who powers through?
I tend to power through. I take a break for meals, but generally speaking, I'm working pretty much all day with a mug of coffee in my hand.
Fair enough. I mean, we're going to get into this now because, I mean, I was looking briefly. I always, for the guests, have a look briefly at their, you know, the LinkedIn and all sorts of different places to see what they do. And every time I looked at a different page of you, it seemed that I found something new that you did. So you're a very busy woman. So you're also involved with the Medieval Academy of America. We'll discuss that one a little bit later because I find that really interesting. But you are also instructor of Latin paleography and fragmentology at the Rare Book School in Virginia and adjunct professor of manuscript studies at Simmons University in the School of sort of Library and Information Science. Both of those seem like very specific topics. And I mean, when we get to the main topic of this episode, that's also quite a specific topic. How did you first get into that topic, into that specialism? What was the sort of path there?
Well, I've always been fascinated by the medieval period. Mm-hmm. And as a child, I was quite obsessed with Lord of the Rings and Tolkien Excellent. And fantasy, mm-hmm. that fantasy genre, mm-hmm. which grows out of an interest in the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. And as a college student, I majored in medieval studies. Mm-hmm. Primarily because I was interested in the history of theater. So I started as studying medieval theater and medieval drama. And as when I was in my final year at university, as one of the required classes was an introduction to working with manuscripts, with mm-hmm. medieval manuscripts. And the material connection, and I'm sure you feel this as an archaeologist, to an artifact as opposed to an image or reading about something, when you actually have a physical artifact in front of you that's 600, 700, 800, 900 years old, you feel that immediate connection with the past. And that really spoke to me as intellectually and emotionally on a really emotional level. Yeah. And so I went on to graduate school at Yale and did a PhD in medieval studies with a specific focus on studying and working with these artifacts that have survived the medieval period. And of equal interest, they're not just medieval, they're medieval European manuscripts that are now in the United States. And so there's always a story there about how these objects crossed the pond and made their way into collections in North America, which is, of course, its own long story. And part of the interest for me is asking those questions. Why are there medieval manuscripts in Iowa? Why are there medieval manuscripts in Utah? Yeah. And how did they get there? And sometimes that's the most interesting part of the story.
I mean, is it a very varied story, or do you see patterns? Is it kind of people brought over, I don't know, things that they'd inherited when they came over to America? Is it stuff that's come post sort of settler period? Or
a lot depends on what period we're talking about. Mm. So the real interest in medieval objects among North American collectors and institutions really begins in the 19th century, where early 20th century, you have people like J.P. Morgan and William Randolph Hearst, who want to establish their bona fides having this connection to Europe and a European pedigree. And part of that is collecting and presenting themselves as owners of this ancient material that they felt helped them to be on an even keel with people who were nobles in England or royalty or wealthy collectors in Europe who they were trying to compete with.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, no, it's really fascinating. I have to admit, that's one aspect that I really didn't even think about. But of course, it's, yeah, they wouldn't, if it's from the medieval period, they wouldn't have originated in America. So that
exactly. I mean, obviously, there was during the period that we think of as the Middle Ages, there were people living in North America.
Yes.
But it's a very different field of study that really doesn't overlap with sort of traditional medieval studies.
Yeah, which indeed. So going back to that, so you mentioned that you started off kind of more in theater studies. I mean, I must admit, I'm a prehistorian, so I have no idea about any kind of written thing, and especially not the medieval period. In terms of kind of the content of manuscripts from, and I'm very aware that the medieval period is a big period, so I know I'm being very general here. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned the sort of theater studies. I mean, is that quite a big portion? Are there kind of, if you get a medieval manuscript, it's likely to be A, B, or C in terms of theme or topic or something like that? Or is it very almost as generalized as it is kind of today in terms of books and what the topic might be?
Well, it's very interesting because in the United States, the corpus of medieval manuscripts that have ended up in collections, and for the most part, we're talking about university special collections, departments, and museums, those tend to be highly decorative, very high-end. They're often related to liturgical practice in what we now call the Catholic Church. And part of that is because those were the objects that were of interest to
status
people
objects,
who were
kind of
acquiring
thing.
Them.
Yeah.
Whereas if you look at a collection in Europe, say the Bibliothèque Nationale or the British Library, it's a much more diverse collection because they were buying and acquiring much more generally, not necessarily because of the visual aspects.
Yeah.
So, for example, in the United States, we have very few complete manuscripts from before the year 1100, whereas, of course, in England, there are quite a lot.
Yeah.
All of those Old English manuscripts, or in Germany or in Italy, in France, you have significantly more because they tend to not be very decorative. And so they weren't the kind of things that were of interest 100-something years ago to buyers in North America. Currently, they are of interest, but they are so outrageously expensive that most universities can no longer afford to buy them.
Fair, yes. So a lot of them are still in the hands of kind of private collectors then?
Many are, yes. Oh. A lot of the finest things that come on the market end up with private collectors, which on the one hand, you hope they're taking good care of them. But on the other hand, it means it's likely not going to be available for study. So there's quite a lot of evidence that scholars don't have access to because it's in private hands.
Yeah. Out of curiosity, is there something like, because I know in England, for example, you have somewhere in the UK, you have the Treasure Trove Act where people, you know, if they find something archaeologically significant, they sort of provide it on loan for research purposes, but they can get it back, or they get some sort of financial reimbursement for it or something like that. Is there a similar thing in the US?
You can obviously get a significant tax break if you make a donation. And certainly there are collectors who have put their material on deposit at libraries or museums where it can be studied. Okay. The majority of the material is not in private hands, I would say.
Okay, that's good. So we have enough. We have enough to go off. Which indeed,
there's so much to do. There's so much material to be studied. Yes.
Which indeed, going back to that, so the sort of process of, so like you say, you sort of became more of a more specialized in this particular topic, in the study of manuscripts, specifically medieval manuscripts. I can just imagine that if you're doing sort of manuscripts, you have to be specifically specialized in them if you're working with objects themselves. Or is this sort of general medieval knowledge kind of good enough? What would you say are the kind of requirements to be able to specialize in that field of study?
So a lot of medievalists are interested in the text and they're interested in the illustration. I would say most medievalists are specifically working with text or illustration, not with the three-dimensional object itself. So if you're going to be a specialist working with the entire object, that specialization is called codicology. So it means the study of the material aspects of a bound book, of a codex. And so that requires significant specialized knowledge. So you need to understand something about all aspects of the book. So not just the text and the illustrations, which you obviously need to be able to identify and work with, but also the composition of the ink. How is the ink made? How are the pigments made? How is the gold applied? How is it bound? What material is it written on? Is it papyrus? Is it parchment? Is it paper? And if so, what can that tell us about the object? What kind of binding is it in? What is its history? How did it get from 8th century France to 21st century Connecticut? You know, those are really important questions. Who owned it? Who read it? Who was it made for? There are all sorts of questions that you want to answer if you are studying the whole object as opposed to just what's written or drawn on the page.
Interesting. So we actually, those of you listeners who heard the last episode will know we talked with Alex Sabir, who is a professional bookbinder, and we talked all about the craft of bookbinding and things. Is that also then something that you have to learn, kind of the actual practical crafting aspect of it? That's fascinating.
Yes, because you want to be able to look at a binding and draw some conclusions about when the binding was added, because sometimes things are rebound multiple times over the course of their lives. Yeah. You often find a 13th century Bible in a 19th century binding. And that's quite common. And so you definitely need to know something about binding structure and binding decoration and the skill and the craft of bookbinding so that you can untangle the relationship between the parchment or the paper of the book and the container that it sits in that protects it.
Oh, that's amazing. It just sounds fantastic because it's a really perfect combination of sort of literary and, you know, theoretical, historical approach, but also a very practical approach as well, which
absolutely.
Great. That's amazing. Correct. And what kinds of then tools do you need or can you use when studying manuscripts? I mean, I'm picturing gloves and
No gloves.
Take heed, listeners.
Brought this up because it's a very common misconception. If I post a picture on social media, with a manuscript and I'm not wearing gloves, I will always get comments that say, why aren't you wearing gloves? I thought you knew what you were doing. And the truth is, especially with parchment, which is animal skin that's been specially prepared to create a writing surface, it's actually more potentially damaging to not use gloves. Because you lose that tactile sensation. You can't tell what your fingers are doing. And you're actually more likely to tear it or to damage it in some way if you can't physically perceive what you're touching and what you're doing. If you're working with a binding that has red rot where the leather is crumbling apart, you should wear gloves. If there's metal, you don't want to touch it without gloves. So there are times and certain kinds of material where gloves are really important. But generally speaking, with medieval manuscripts, the best practice is to not wear gloves. And if you Google medieval manuscripts gloves, you will find a blog post from the conservator at the British Library explaining that misconception and why you're better off not wearing gloves. So gloves are not part of my kit for studying manuscripts. The main thing you need is a camera of some kind. Mm-hmm. I just use my phone. Huh. Something to take measurements with. So I have a measuring tape that I bring with me everywhere I go. And I also have a very small portable ultraviolet light.
Oh, fancy. Okay.
That can be extremely important. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you why if you would like to know.
Yeah.
The reason that ultraviolet light is so useful is because parchment has certain qualities, and the ink that manuscripts tend to be written in is a highly acidic oak gall ink, and it bites into the surface of the parchment and forms a molecular bond if it's properly prepared. If it's not properly prepared, it could just slide right off the surface of the parchment.
I've heard of this, but it sounds too weird, but it is the case indeed.
Absolutely. And if it's too acidic, it can eat right through the parchment. So it's a very delicate balance. And there are lots of different recipes that medieval scribes used for their ink so that it would interact correctly and as intended with the parchment. Mm-hmm. What this means is that you can't erase it if you make a mistake, but you can take a little knife and scrape the ink off of the surface. That scraped off area leaves a molecularly bonded but invisible to the naked eye residue that fluoresces under ultraviolet light. And it can, under really great circumstances, allow you to read something that has been scraped away or written over and under ultraviolet light. Is a really extraordinary and very exciting technology.
Very cool. Medieval spyware.
Yes, totally. 100%. We are all spies. That's a fact.
I imagine it would only work on medieval manuscripts, though, because you probably couldn't do the same thing with modern.
Well, it won't work on paper.
No.
It will, it will work on parchment. Okay. There are other processes and strategies you can use on paper, but in terms of the ultraviolet light is a technique that you use for oak gall ink on parchment. And this is applicable to the manuscript we're going to discuss here.
Well, what a good segue. Because indeed, the reason that I have Lisa here is not just to talk about how cool medieval manuscripts are, which apparently they are very cool, but also to talk about a very specific medieval manuscript. But first, we're going to have a quick break to top up our tea, and I'm going to throw away these gloves that I had prepared here, but we'll be right back soon. Welcome back, everyone. I hope the teacup is fuller and the biscuit jar is emptier. So as I was saying before the break, I didn't just get Lisa to join me here today to chat all about their work, however interesting it is, because I also wanted to help pick her brains on a very specific topic, a very specific manuscript, which I personally find really fascinating, because not only do I know nothing about medieval manuscripts or the medieval period, but just I'm always a sucker for a mystery object. And today we're going to chat about I'm going to say it like this. We'll see if it's correct. The Voynich manuscript?
Correct.
Yes. Excellent. So, yeah, the Voynich manuscript, which maybe you can first explain. So what actually is the Voynich manuscript?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. So the Voynich manuscript is a manuscript, which means it is written by hand, entirely by hand, by humans, and it is a object that belongs to Yale University. The reason it has drawn so much attention over the years is that it is written in a completely unknown alphabet. Let's call it a symbol set or a glyph set, because we don't know if it's an alphabet. We don't actually know what these symbols represent. So it is written in using a group of symbols that are completely unique. They've never been found as a complete set in any other manuscripts. And it is illustrated with illustrations that are really, I hesitate to say otherworldly, that's a dangerous word, but they are really bizarre plants that sometimes look like they're recognizable and sometimes they aren't. There are pages that have signs of the zodiac in the center. There are star charts and suns and moons. There are naked ladies bathing in pools of water. Very bizarre diagrams that look like internal organs. The female reproductive system seems to be illustrated on one page. And it's just entirely uninterpretable. And it has led to a lot of discussion over the years.
Well, and I just, because I had never heard of it. And it was, I was chatting to some friends of mine and they mentioned it in passing about something. And I was going, what are you talking about? What's the Voynich manuscript? And then I looked it up and I actually even ordered myself a book, which is like a copy of it.
Oh, good. Sort of the Ray Clemens edition.
Exactly.
Yes, that's a great book. Highly recommended for anyone who wants a good introduction to the manuscript.
It's really fascinating. Yeah. So I'll give a link to it in the show notes if anyone's interested. And indeed, looking through it, I was going, what on, like you say, what on earth is these drawings? They're very, very interesting. So if people are listening and really don't have a clue what the Voynich manuscript is, I mean, I think indeed Lisa gave a very good introduction just then to the slightly bizarre pictures and the very odd script, I guess, or symbols that are within it. But yeah, definitely go and have a look if you can. I'll put some links in the show notes so you can go and find some things.
Yeah, the entire manuscript is digitized in high resolution, open access images on the Yale website. So anyone can go and download a PDF of the entire manuscript or do whatever you want with it. There are no permissions necessary. It's all open access.
What do we actually know about this manuscript?
Because that is a big question. So there's actually a lot that we know.
Okay,
so
that's good.
Let's start with the history of the object. If we sort of work our way backwards, the first time it appears in the historic record is in the early 1600s, when it belongs to an alchemist or natural philosopher in Prague named Jacob Sinopius. And he was part of the imperial court of the Holy Roman Empire, which was at that point based in Prague. And he worked for the Holy Roman Emperor Rudolf II. And we know he owned it because using ultraviolet light and multispectral imagery, you can see his signature at the bottom of the very first page.
Okay.
There has always been a rumor that before that it belonged to the emperor himself. We don't know that for sure. That's a maybe. And we have no idea really where it was before that. We just don't know. But let's go forward from there. So from Sinopius, it goes to someone named Georg Barasch, who was his heir. And from Barasch, it goes to Johannes Marcus Marki. So all three of these men were scholars in Prague.
Okay.
Marki gets the manuscript, I believe, around 1660-ish. Okay. And he sends it as a gift to Athanasius Kircher, who is a very well-known scholar, Jesuit scholar in Rome. And Marki writes a letter to Kircher where he says, I don't know what to do with this crazy thing, but I'll bet
it's your problem now.
Anyone can read it, you can, because Kircher had written a book about Egyptian hieroglyphs. So because these have kind of a glyphic feeling to them, Marki thought, I'm sending it to Kircher. So he sends it to Athanasius Kircher, and we have no idea if Kircher really was interested. You know, there's some correspondence where he seems to mention it, but we don't really know for sure. And it just kind of sits there in a Jesuit library in Rome until 1912.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And as far, for all we know, it just sat on a shelf for you know, 300 years. We just don't know what the Jesuits did with it. If anything, it might have just sat on a bookcase in their library. In 1912, so the story goes, and again, we don't know this 100% for sure, but the story goes, the Jesuits needed some money. They had to sell off some books. And Wilfred Voynich was a bookseller in London, and he bought from the Jesuits in Rome a whole bunch of books and manuscripts, printed books and manuscripts, including what became known as the Voynich manuscript.
Right. Okay.
And he then bought it. He brought it with him to when he opened shop in New York City. He brought it with him and he immediately started trying to sell it. And he hired he collaborated with a scholar at the University of Pennsylvania named William Newbold to try and figure out what it was. And Newbold had this great theory that it was written by Roger Bacon, who was a 13th century person.
Okay. I was about to say, that sounds like some sort of Bond villain or something. But
well, so Roger Bacon was himself a scientist, philosopher. You know, those aren't really the right words for the 13th century.
13th century versions, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And he got in some trouble with the church because of his interests. Mm-hmm. And Newbold was a scholar of Roger Bacon. And so he decided the manuscript must have been written by Roger Bacon. And so they had this big announcement. There was a conference where they both gave papers about it and said, you know, this is going to change the history of the world because Roger Bacon invented the telescope in the 13th century and Roger Bacon invented the microscope in the 13th century. It was all nonsense. And it was really a way to help Voynich sell this thing by attaching this famous name to it. And eventually Newbold was completely debunked in the 1930s. And then after Voynich died, his wife inherited it. Her name was Ethel Voynich. And she outlived him by 30 years.
Oh, wow.
And all that time, he went out of business. They liquidated everything until all they had left was the Voynich manuscript. And she and her assistant, whose name was Anne Mill. So Ethel is trying to get people interested in the manuscript so that she can sell it. But because no one can read it, no one will buy it. Mm-hmm. And after Ethel dies, it's inherited by Anne. Anne can't sell it. Eventually, she sells it at a deep discount to a bookseller in New York named Hans Krauss. So then he's trying to sell it all through the 1960s, and he can't get anyone to buy it. And finally, because people are clamoring to study it, but no one wants to buy it, he gives it to Yale in 1969 so that it can be studied. And so it has been at Yale since 1969 with the shelf mark Manuscript 408, which is its official name.
Okay.
And it is known as the Voynich manuscript because of Wilfred Voynich.
Interesting. That is a intense object biography.
Yes. Well, this is one of the most studied medieval objects on the planet. So it makes sense that we would know a lot about it. But we don't know where it was prior to the 1600s. There are clues. There are lots of clues. There are annotations that look to be in some dialect of French. There are zodiac names of the months next to the zodiac that also appear to be in some kind of romance language. There are other annotations that seem like they might be German. So it seems like the manuscript had kind of a lot of travels before it landed in Prague.
Yeah.
But we just don't know for sure who owned it and where they lived.
Oh, wow. So we have no idea who wrote it, no idea when it was written or anything like that.
Well, we do have some clues about when it was created because carbon 14 testing was done on the parchment.
Excellent.
So, and as you certainly know, and many of your listeners will as well, carbon 14 is a way of dating an organic growing thing and telling you when it stopped growing, so when it died. So for parchment, and this is calf skin or cow skin parchment generally, that tells us approximately when the animal was slaughtered so that its skin could be made into parchment. And in the case of the Voynich, the carbon 14 dating put us around 1425 or so.
Oh, okay.
You know, but As some people will say, if you ask this question to the internet, you will get a lot of people saying, well, yeah, but couldn't the parchment sit around for 500 years until...
Well, I was just about to ask.
Fake the manuscript.
Yeah, because I mean, that's, I guess, one of the questions with one of the issues as well. I did a whole episode on this indeed. So hopefully people listening will remember that one. And one of the points I made was, of course, you need to be careful because just because a tree died at that time doesn't mean it was...
Exactly. So you always have to know, what are you actually learning from this evidence? And so the evidence, all it really tells us is that the animals that made the parchment, that gave us their skin and for which we are grateful, died in the early 1400s.
Okay.
So we know that for a fact. Yeah. So could the parchment sit around blank for hundreds of years until someone, and so the theory goes, Wilfred Voynich, found it and decided to create this manuscript as a fake? Yes, I will concede that is remotely possible. It is extremely unlikely, extremely unlikely. And if you want to get into that, I can tell you why that's unlikely.
We have some time left in this part of the episode if you want to get into it.
Imagine, if you will, Wilfred Voynich, just for the sake of argument, finds all this blank parchment, authentic medieval parchment, and he decides to use it to create this manuscript in order to put it on the market and make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So, and that has certainly been done in the past.
I was about to ask.
The Spanish forger did that all the time.
Ah,
he took real parchment, put paintings on it, and then pretended it was an authentic medieval object.
So you could hypothetically have blank medieval manuscripts.
Yes, you totally could.
Oh,
so the Spanish forger, another example is something called the Vinland map, which also is at Yale.
Okay.
Both of those are on authentic parchment, mm-hmm. but are 19th, 20th century forgeries. But the reason we know that is because of X-ray fluorescence and material testing of the inks and pigments. In both of those cases, the Spanish forger and the Vinland map, there were chemical components of the inks and pigments that were clearly modern, not medieval.
No.
And so these were identified as they could not be medieval.
Yeah.
Nothing like that has ever been found in the Voynich manuscripts. Mm. So all of the inks that were tested, all of the pigments that have been tested are consistent with medieval recipes. There isn't anything in them that hints that it was a modern creation. Now, if you were, say, Wilfred Voynich and it's 1912 and you decide you want to create this project, why would you go to the trouble in 1912 of crafting inks and pigments that were absolutely in line with medieval recipes when the tests for those did not yet exist? Right. There's absolutely no reason that you would do that. You would just take ink. Why would it even occur to you that 100 years later, someone would be able to do those tests? So that's one piece.
Although maybe you had the time machine that Roger Bacon invented.
Exactly. The same goes for the multispectral imaging response on the first page, where you can see the signature of Jacob Stenapius. Why would you, if you were Wilfred Voynich, why would it even occur to you to write the signature and then erase it? Mm-hmm. So that 100 years from now, someone could find it.
Yeah, it's quite a detailed plot.
Yes, exactly. It just doesn't hold up. And I have studied the manuscript in person at least a dozen times, as much or more than anyone, I think, almost anyone. And there is nothing in it that is inconsistent with an authentic 15th century manuscript object.
Okay, well, I think, unfortunately, we might be running out of time on this particular tea break, but I think there's a lot more to discuss. So don't worry, everyone who's listening. There will definitely be another episode coming up in 2 weeks' time where I will be chatting further with Lisa all about the Voynich manuscript and how it has been researched so far. So make sure to join us for that. I hope that you enjoyed this tea break, everyone. If you did, please do like, follow, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN as well for more fun archaeology content. If you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode and see all of the references that we referred to, or learn more about Lisa's work, you can find all of the links, contact information, and other relevant links in the show notes.
you for joining me on this tea break. If you like this episode, please do like, follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode, make sure to check the show notes for links and further information.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.